Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue, Tuesday, February the 13th, 2007. At this time, we're going to have a report on the cigarette tax revenue dealing with Senate Bill 181. Have you folks come on up to the dais and be ready to speak and tell us who is going to decide who's going to go first. The idea that we're going to do a work session on that other bill, we'll wait until our chair gets here. So you guys are ready. When you're ready, go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Vice Chair George, members of the committee, good morning. For the record, my name is Cheryl Pellegrini. I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice, Criminal Justice Division, and within my division we have staff dedicated to the multi-agency tobacco tax compliance task force, and that task force is part of the subject of Senate Bill 181. With me as well, there is Lieutenant Mike Dingeman, from the Oregon State Police, Criminal Division, Drug Enforcement, and Jack Ogami, who is the Business Administration or Business Division,
Administrator
for the Department of Revenue. Also with us today, Mr. Vice Chair, is Donna Maddox. And Donna Maddox is an Assistant Attorney General. She's the lead attorney assigned to the Tobacco Enforcement Unit. And there is Sergeant Derek Bischoff, assigned to the unit, and then Don Jones, who is the manager for the Department of Revenue. In presenting this on this bill today, we would like to present it with the aid of a PowerPoint, and instead of each agency going separately, what we've done is we've divvied up the slides. There are about 15 slides, and so we've each taken responsibility for a different part of the presentation, and we'll sort of switch off between us as we go. There are two written documents before you. One is written testimony in support of Senate Bill 181, and the other is a hard copy of the PowerPoint, which we'll be giving to you momentarily.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jack Ogami, and as Cheryl mentioned, I'm the Business Division Administrator of the Oregon Department of Revenue. And this morning we're here to provide testimony in favor of Senate Bill 181. But before we began, we thought it would be a good idea to provide a high-level overview of Oregon's tobacco taxes and our role in supporting this important revenue stream. On slide one, you can see that the 07-09 estimate for tobacco revenues is over $500 million, and the primary beneficiaries of this important revenue stream are the Oregon Health Plan and the state's general funds. The state's cost of administering the tobacco tax programs for 07-09 is estimated to be approximately $5.4 million, or about 1% of the total revenues. On slide two, the Department of Revenue provides the general support functions such as banking money and processing returns for those who choose to voluntarily comply with Oregon's tobacco tax laws. The 2001 legislature created a multi-agency task force, now known as the Tobacco Compliance Task Force, to deal with those who do not comply with Oregon's tobacco tax laws. The Department of Revenue's role on that task force is to promote voluntary compliance through audits and inspections of retail outlets. Our partners, the Oregon State Police and the Department of Justice, they focus on criminal investigations, pursuing indictments for criminal behavior and criminal prosecution. The next slide. Oregon has two tobacco taxes. The first and the largest is the tax on cigarettes. The tax on cigarettes is $1.18 per pack, and the way we collect this tax is through the sale of tobacco tax stamps to distributors. The presence of a tobacco tax stamp on a package of cigarettes easily proves compliance with Oregon's tobacco or cigarette tax laws. The tax on all other tobacco products, such as chew, cigars, and roll your own, is known as the other tobacco products tax. And the way this tax works is that licensed distributors buy untaxed product, and then on a quarterly basis, they file a return where they voluntarily assess, or where they self-assess a tax based on 65% of the wholesale value of the product. Other tobacco products don't bear any evidence of payment of the tax, so validation of compliance is more difficult than cigarettes. So this concludes the high-level overview of Oregon's tobacco taxes and our role in supporting this important revenue stream. And I believe Cheryl will take it from here.
Thanks, Jack. Again, for the record, Cheryl Pellegrini. I'm going to talk a little bit now about Senate Bill 181. Funding for the tobacco tax enforcement and administration program has, since 2003, come out of tobacco and cigarette tax revenues. And that was a result of House Bill 2368. In providing this funding stream for the tobacco tax enforcement and administration program, 2003 legislature noted that the funding stream would be available until December 31st, 2007. They, when they enacted House Bill 2368, was enacted with a specific sunset clause in it. Currently, the costs of the Tobacco Compliance Task Force and the administration program come off the top of the revenues that are generated, and then the balance is distributed to the beneficiaries according to law. So in that regard, all beneficiaries essentially share in the administration of the Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force. What Senate Bill 181 would do is that it would eliminate that sunset and continue funding, as it is now, for the administration enforcement from tobacco tax revenues in the form of a continuous appropriation. No general fund dollars have been used since 2003 to support this program, and Senate Bill 181 would continue that as well. It makes it possible for each agency to continue to dedicate staff to the task force and to compliance and enforcement efforts, and we'll talk a little bit later about the importance of that. A few fast facts about the Tobacco Compliance Task Force. It was created by the Oregon legislature in 2001. In this regard, Oregon was way out in front of the rest of the states because it still, today, is the only program of its kind in the nation, and we're actually a model for other states. What I mean by that is that we are the only state that has a multi-agency task force comprised of Department of Revenue, State Police, and Department of Justice, with dedicated staff, statewide enforcement capabilities, that whose sole function is to protect the revenue stream and to ensure compliance with state tax laws. No other state is configured this way. And again, the three bullets up there are essentially the mission of the Tobacco Task Force. This, as you can imagine, allows for much greater efficiency and effectiveness, but also the big benefit to the sustained enforcement effort that we've promoted here is that by having a sustained presence in the marketplace, we find that it has had a much greater deterrent impact in causing people to pay taxes, which they have heretofore avoided. Currently, the Tobacco Tax Compliance Task Force is comprised of 20 FTE from the three agencies. With our written testimony in support of Senate Bill 181, we've gone ahead and attached either the policy option package or the fiscal impact statement so that you can see the fiscal impact and the cost of the task force. In short, the total estimated cost for 2007-2009, as Jack mentioned earlier in his testimony, is about $5.4 million. Now, the fiscal impact of Senate Bill 181 will be less than that because, as I mentioned, the funding stream sunsets December 31st. So Senate Bill 181 will provide funding for 18 months out of the next biennium. So it will be a total of about $4.2 million, less any revenue that is generated by the efforts of the task force. And each agency has also submitted a policy option package within their agency budgets that relates back to Senate Bill 181. The task force, I keep talking about compliance and enforcement. I want to tell you just a little bit about the laws that we enforce. Essentially, there are three laws. They're all found in Chapter 323 of the Oregon Revised Statutes, the Cigarette Tax Act, the Tobacco Tax Act, and the Delivery Sales Act. The cigarette and tobacco tax laws target generally in-state sales. They lay out the requirements for licensing, payment of tax, and maintenance of records. They provide for civil and criminal penalties for violations. And I would note that in 2003, the Assembly provided for enhanced criminal penalties for violations of these acts. They went from misdemeanors to felonies. And that has also enhanced our enforcement efforts. These laws are enforced using what we call traditional compliance methods, including inspections by the Department of Revenue and audits, and then criminal investigations by the Oregon State Police, followed by prosecutions by the Department of Justice. Delivery Sales Act is a little bit different. That refers to the regulation of non-face-to-face sales of tobacco products and cigarettes to Oregon consumers. So you're dealing with out-of-state sellers selling to in-state buyers. It includes sales that are conducted by phone, fax, internet, mail order, and then shipped to consumers via any common carrier within the state. Oregon is one of about 25 states that currently directly regulate or restrict delivery sales, and there are actually three states, New York, Maryland, Ohio, that prohibit them altogether. The delivery sales law in Oregon places reporting, shipping, age verification, and licensing requirements on the sellers. Oregon's delivery sales reporting requirement for the sales of cigarettes is very much like the Federal Jenkins Act, which requires non-face-to-face sellers to report their cigarette sales into a particular state to the Department of Revenue in that state. At the same time, I think it's about the 10th of the month for the month preceding. Oregon's application of the delivery sales laws to other tobacco products, that's chew and anything other than cigarettes, is unique. The Jenkins Act does not apply to other tobacco products.
Cheryl?
Yes?
Do you go after the seller, out-of-state seller, or do you go after the person who received it in Oregon, or both?
Mr. Vice Chair, we go after delivery sales of other tobacco products. Mostly what we're talking about is sales out of Oregon to retailers within the state. And so the answer to that question is that we go after the retailers mm-hmm. in the state criminally. If you're talking about cigarettes, and Lieutenant Dingaman will talk about this in a little bit more detail in a minute, the Department of Revenue will bill consumers in the state that have bought cigarettes from out-of-state seller, non-tax paid. The Department of Revenue will send them a tax bill. And we'll pursue that. They're not pursued criminally. They're pursued mm-hmm. More from a regulatory perspective.
Thanks.
So as I said, Oregon's application of delivery sales requirements on other tobacco product sellers is fairly unique. And as you might imagine, because we're dealing with out-of-state sellers, we have had to devise different and sometimes fairly creative ways of gaining their compliance with Oregon laws. Some of these methods have included a multi-state effort by the National Association or through the National Association of Attorneys General to persuade the credit card companies who are processing payments to stop processing payments for sales of cigarettes over the Internet. Shortly after we brokered that deal, what that did is it had the effect of requiring Internet cigarette sellers to begin reporting their sales to states. In large scale, probably for the first time since the inception of the Jenkins Act. We've also identified sellers through various means into Oregon, and we've sent them notices, putting them on notice of the fact that they are required under Oregon law, if they're going to sell other tobacco products, to be licensed as a distributor and to pay tax. And we've actually had really good compliance with as a result of these notices that we've sent out. And then we've also conducted some traditional undercover law enforcement stings to identify unlawful sellers and prosecute them. And I believe that Lieutenant Bingham is going to tell you a little bit more about that.
Chair Deckert, members of the committee, I'm Lieutenant Mike Dingham, and I'm with the Oregon State Police, and I oversee our drug enforcement section, which oversees the OSP component of the Tobacco Compliance Task Force. The next three slides that are going to come up are going to deal more with the investigations that we conduct and how we identify the tax avoidance and which tax avoidance that we're going to pursue. And the model that we pretty much follow is just traditional law enforcement, where we develop an investigative lead, or we identify that. We collect evidence, we execute search warrants, and then once we execute that search warrants, we'll seize paper records, computer records, bring that back to the task force. We use all the resources within the task force to identify that tax avoidance and what level of crime we're looking at. Based on that information, we'll decide what we're going to go after criminally and what we're going to go after civilly and what we think is going to be the best avenue for collecting that tax that's avoided. When we develop the leads, there's a number of sources of information that we use in order to develop those investigations. There's a tip line at the Department of Revenue where people can call in and provide us information. The compliance inspectors at DOR employees will go out and do inspections on stores. In the course of doing that, those inspections will develop investigative leads. And while in the course of executing these search warrants and looking at the computer records and the paper records that the people we're going after have, we'll often develop further leads into other people that, you know, and we're talking back to the organized crime, other retail stores, other distributors, et cetera. And then finally, the internet invoices that Cheryl was talking about, from those we're often able to go back and mirror up and match up people who are, especially with OTP, that are avoiding tax, and then going back and doing audits on those folks, and then the ones that are at the higher levels, we'll look at taking those folks criminally. The next slide, the next two slides, more or less break out. Cheryl talked a little bit about the Jenkins Act and the non-face-to-face transactions. And what we're doing there is back, as Cheryl referred to, in the 2003 legislature, the laws that were enacted that went into effect in January of 2004 gave us the ability to do some things with those non-face-to-face people that were selling product into Oregon. And in May of 2005, we were able to identify what we thought were three of the largest internet providers selling cigarettes into the state that were owned and operated by a single entity. And by working through the Department of Justice at the national level, we were able to work with credit card carriers and common carriers to put pressure on those companies to report to us the people that they were selling to in Oregon. Although they were federally required to do that under the Jenkins Act and through our Oregon Sales Delivery Act, they were not doing that. So in working with those credit card companies and out of fear that they were going to lose money themselves, they started reporting those invoices to us as to the people in Oregon that were buying the cigarettes. And that's what Cheryl referred to as the, you know, then that gets sent over to DOR and what we call the Jenkins billings, where people are getting a bill for the cigarettes that they're buying. The next thing, that was on the cigarette side. On the OTP side, which we have to deal with just a little bit differently because the tax structure is different. You don't have, you know, it's a self-reporting tax structure, so it really opens the door for cheating, and it makes it very easy to cheat, and it makes it very difficult for compliance inspectors when they go in and inspect these stores to find out who's not reporting, because if they're hiding their stock, you know, you're only going to see the stock that they want you to see, so you're not going to know. Well, we worked with two of the largest OTP distributors, and one of them being House of Oxfords. And through doing undercover work and working with the Department of Justice, we were able to enter into an agreement, what we call assurance of voluntary compliance, which was basically a deferral of prosecution, that we're not going to prosecute you for these crimes and selling OTP into Oregon if you'll provide us your information on who you're selling to. So we started getting those invoices, and then as a task force reviewing those invoices, develop a threshold at which we'll refer to the tax auditors for DOR to go back and reconcile with those quarterly reports they were issuing, and then taking care of that civilly. And on the upper end, if it looked like we had crimes and retail stores were working together and selling to each other, then those were the ones we were investigating and going after criminally.
Mike, are we able to do anything about out-of-state tribal sales? Because I've looked at the website a couple of times over the last few years, and it seems like a lot of them are our Native American tribal sales. Is that the case, and is there anything we can do? The other question I had, if you could answer at the same time, was do we require that anyone who's now selling, does Jenkins do that? Does it provide that they will collect the tax and remit it to Oregon, or are we just pursuing our citizens' order?
On the latter question, Chair or Vice Chair George, with regards to Jenkins, the distributor that's selling in Oregon has two options. They can get a distributor license from the state of Oregon, buy the tax stamps, apply that to the cigarettes, and then ship it to Oregon. That would be the correct way to do it. But in the event where they're not doing that, where they're just selling directly to Oregon residents, then that's where the Jenkins Act kicks in. And if they're not doing that, paying those tax stamps, so then they have to report those invoices to us by the 10th of every month for the preceding month's transactions. With regards to the tribal folks, one of the larger OTP distributors that we've been working with is Little Brown Smoke Shop up in Yakima. And we've been working on that one for quite some time, and in cooperation with working with some federal agencies, IRS and Postal Service, there was some search warrants that were initiated up there under the premise of mail fraud and wire fraud because of the dealings that they were doing into Oregon, and we were able to get a lot of the records of those transactions that he was where he was conducting business with Oregonians, and that continues to be an ongoing case. And if we go to the next slide, which is tobacco offenders in Oregon, and this is more of what we would call our it's a combination of what I was just talking to you a little bit about, but it's more of our face-to-face type stuff that's going on here in Oregon. And when we're trying to decide who we want to go after criminally, who we want to go after civilly, on the criminal side, we're looking at large distributors. We're looking at retail stores who are working together, a number of them, in order to avoid tax. And like we were just talking, we learn about those folks through when we're doing search warrants and the paper documents that they all have that relate each other, or the OTP that they're purchasing over the Internet. We're able to get to them through the invoices that way. And then at the retail store operators who are importing and selling non-tax products, and then the other side is the folks that are getting their hands on the unstamped cigarettes and the contraband, the stuff that, for example, is coming out of Mexico. When we're looking at these investigations as to which ones we want to go with, we're typically, when we're considering criminal prosecution investigation, we're looking at those that are rising to the felony level or higher, and those that are below that, then we try to refer those to tax audits and civil remedies through the abilities that the Department of Revenue has available to them.
And as for the results of our efforts, what we've done is we've charted out for you, since the inception of the task force in 2001, some of the significant financial results. And we have expressed it in terms of, first, tax avoidance identified. That's the sort of light turquoise blue bar. And what that means is that we prosecute people or businesses who are engaged in tobacco tax evasion. It stops the current scheme, and it also prevents future loss. And as a result of those investigations, we're usually able to identify the amount of tax that they have evaded up to the date or through which we've conducted the investigation. We haven't projected that out into the future to create a future number. What we're reporting there is the actual amount of tax avoidance that we have been able to identify through the efforts of the task force and on which we've taken some action. So that's that bar. We've compared that with the amount that we've actually been able to recoup or collect in taxes owed, and then finally compared that to what the task force has cost to operate. And a couple of things that you probably noticed. In 2001, the task force was just starting out. So as you might expect, our collections and tax identify were low, and we had a cost there. In 2002, you'll see that we began to conduct investigations. We identified some tax avoided and were able to collect some. Big spike in 2003 in the amount of tax avoidance that we were able to identify. This was due to a couple of things. One, it was the third year of operation for the task force, and two, that was the year that the legislature added staff in the form of compliance specialists and investigators. So it really expanded our capacity to go out there and conduct investigations and identify who was out there engaging in the greatest amounts of tax evasion in the state. The collections for 2003 are pretty paltry, and that's because the large amount of tax avoidance that we identified in 2003, that's comprised of basically two big cases. One was Willamette Valley Distributing out of Eugene. I think that they were one of the biggest distribution...
Portland.
Biggest distribution companies in the state were engaging in extensive tax evasion. And then a second case, which was the Hartley case. So that big bar, two cases. The reason that we were not able to collect a whole lot is because shortly after we concluded our prosecution of Willamette Valley, they went into bankruptcy. And so that really hampered our effort and our ability to collect back taxes owed. And that is a sort of a continuing issue that we face. In 2004, you'll notice that there's a big spike in costs. That reflects the added staff in 2003. And then in 2005, there's a spike in tax avoidance that we identified. And that's as a result of we had staff in 2004. They conduct investigations, and then we work through those investigations and then result in our prosecution, at which time, or whatever agency action we're going to take, at which time we've usually identified the total amount of tax avoided. So you can see it's a little bit cyclical in nature. The other problems that we've had with collections that really present a challenge is that the offenders tend to be big spenders. So they make a lot of money, they spend a lot of money. If they keep it, they don't keep it in places that are easy for us to identify. They tend to hide it or secrete it away. They often move their assets around. And in some cases, once we begin our investigation, if they don't have significant ties to the state, they'll shutter their business and they'll leave, and it's very difficult for us to catch up with them. In addition to those results, you know, our enforcement efforts have had other results too. I mentioned the tax avoidance identified. Another result is that as a direct consequence of both Jenkins Billings and, more importantly, or equally importantly, prosecution of the organized enterprises responsible for bringing in and selling tobacco product, we find that our sustained effort has had a deterrent effect. Word is starting to get out. And the way that we know that is because we hear about it in these small circles. We, the Department of Revenue, have heard from consumers who tell them that they used to buy from internet sites or they used to buy from this store on the corner, and they always wondered why they could buy their cigarettes cheaper. And then they found out why, because they were avoiding taxes and evading taxes. And as a consequence of our action, they've now gone back, and now they're buying from traditional brick-and-mortar, legitimate Oregon businesses. So in addition to all of the other effects of the task force, it has had the effect of being a boon for legitimate businesses, because it's driven business to them, and it's also driven out those illegal or unscrupulous sellers that really have created an unlevel playing field and gained an unfair competitive advantage by employing tax evasion schemes in order to sell for less.
Chair Dickert.
Thank you. Cheryl, so one question on the previous slide. It seems we are identifying a number of... The identification seems pretty impressive, at least according to the bar, but the collection doesn't seem as impressive. Why the disparity? And you would hope, as years pass, that as we identify more, that the folks seated to your left would then the collection would go up proportionally, and it doesn't seem to.
Chair Deckett, actually, we're doing better. If you'll notice, the collections are up, and I think that it's a combination of factors. As I said, some of the biggest offenders who have been responsible for the largest amount of tax evasion. By the time we conclude our investigations, or sometimes by the time we identify them, they've dissipated their assets. So they've made a lot of money, and they've moved it out of state, or they've spent it. You'll see the perfect example. There's a little embedded video that we'll show you here in a minute of a couple. They ran Sons Wholesale. It was a case that we concluded last year. And I think in the week before the sentencing, month before, it was a couple, the Nguyen's, and Mrs. Nguyen had managed to plug $692,000 into the slot machines out at Spirit Mountain.
Oh, okay.
So that's who we're dealing with.
$692,000.
Yes, in a month. So as a result, our ability to collect from these people is compromised, or can be.
Unbelievable. I'm aware of that.
Well, Cheryl, just let me, are you sure she put it in those slot machines? Mm-hmm. Are you okay?
Mr. Vice Chair, we are, because we were able to obtain records from the casino, which told us how much she put in, not necessarily how much she lost or gained, but how much she spent. So we did know that.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the thought actually occurs to me, and you are the lawyers, I wonder if there's any way to set up with, since so often these cases turn to gambling, or is there a way to set up with our tribal government friends some sort of arrangement to catch folks who are spending $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 in a month or two
to identify,
because obviously after it's spent, it's gone.
Possibly, Mr. Chair, although I think that they would have perhaps a difficult time identifying the source of the funds that people are using. I mean, I imagine there are probably some fairly high rollers in the state, not all of whom are tobacco tax evaders, although many may be. And I'm just not sure how we'd identify them, although I also suspect that the tribes may have a fairly good idea because of the frequency with which they patronize their establishments of who the high rollers are. Mm-hmm. So, and with that, yes, we have a video here. This was actually it's a video clip of an investigative report on tax evasion that was conducted last year by KGW Kyle Eboshi. And it also is an example of one of our distributor cases involving the illegal sales of other tax or other tobacco products. And it sort of shows who these people are and how much money is to be made and how they live.
Organized crime rings are cashing in by smuggling cigarettes and tobacco. News Channel 8's Kyle Eboshi is here with more on what's big business in the criminal underworld. Kyle?
Joe, state taxpayers are the ones getting hurt. They're losing millions of dollars a year in this racket. Untaxed tobacco is being smuggled into the state.
It's a very nice house. How do you pay for this house?
Juan Nguyen lives the good life. He's got a $1 million home in Happy Valley. 6,000 square foot estate is tucked in an exclusive hilltop neighborhood, and DMV records show he has a fleet of luxury cars.
I don't know.
So how did Nguyen make big money?
There are multiple issues.
Prosecutors say by smuggling tobacco.
You can make a lot of money doing tobacco tax evasion.
Nguyen and his wife are now facing racketeering charges.
You know anything about tobacco distribution? You know nothing about it?
No.
Prosecutors say the scam was simple. Nguyen would buy large quantities of untaxed tobacco from two companies, one in New York, the other on an Indian reservation in Yakima. Then he'd turn around and sell the tobacco to unsuspecting retailers in Oregon at a higher price, pretending to pay tax.
Call his number.
Instead, he'd pocket the money.
At a minimum, $500,000 in tax avoided.
The state figures it loses millions of dollars every year to tobacco tax cheats.
We've recognized that this is an organized crime issue.
This is one load that we took down, and it was occurring on a weekly basis. This is about $100,000 worth of product that we seized just a little over a year ago.
These crime rings know they can make big money fast by moving untaxed tobacco.
The product is coming and going within days of picking up, you know, a load like this.
Elsewhere around the country, smuggling cigarettes has been used as a fundraiser for terrorist organizations. Prosecutors say there are no terrorism connections in Oregon.
What you see here is a very small portion.
But tobacco smuggling does help fuel other crimes.
Most of them are looking for a quick buck.
Oregon is the only state with a tobacco task force to take on these smugglers. Over the past few years, investigators have raided numerous illegal operations. They caught smugglers red-handed and sent them to prison. Tobacco tax money is supposed to go to state coffers, but instead, prosecutors say, it's often siphoned by smugglers looking to live the good life.
And be warned, the state is not just going after the big offenders, but anyone who buys tobacco or cigarettes out of state or online in order to avoid paying tax. The Department of Revenue is now reviewing invoices from tobacco suppliers. It's seeking unpaid tax from millions of people. Back to you, Kyle.
The Nguyens were prosecuted. They evaded a total of $1.4 million in tobacco taxes due on other tobacco products since 2001. They pled guilty to five felony counts, one count of racketeering, and four counts of tobacco tax evasion, which are B felonies. We asked the court to impose prison consistent with sentencing guidelines, which would have called for a 32-month prison sentence, and they were sentenced by the court to 30 days and 5 years supervised probation plus $500,000 in restitution. They are still in that house. The Department of Revenue does have a lien on the property. We have been back to court twice on probation violations, and we're continuing in our efforts to get them to pay. So another challenge in collection, as you can see, is even after prosecution, we continue our efforts to make them pay what they owe and what the court has now ordered. But that often requires us to continue to expend time, funds, and labor in going back to court.
Cheryl, when I look at $500 million in revenue and the potential, you know, for the corruption that could involve that much money, and I think about the fact that if you got heavy enforcement on Highway 5, they're not driving 75 and 80 miles an hour. They're doing, you know, 55, 65, whatever they're enforcing. But if you pull the enforcement out for even a little small amount of time, all of a sudden we're all back driving 70, 75 again. So I would imagine it's the same thing here. I mean, when I look at the revenue numbers, I thought, well, gee, that's not a lot beyond what is costing us to do. In other words, we're not achieving as much as we'd hoped. But on the other side of that is what happens if you don't enforce. Do we have any numbers to compare with some of the states that are really doing not much? I would imagine their revenue as a percentage of estimated sales is way lower than ours.
Mr. Vice Chair, I don't know if Donna, do you have any information? I'm not sure that we do. What we hear anecdotally, because we, actually Donna and her colleague and people from Revenue and State Police just went to a Western States Tobacco Tax Administrators Conference. What we do hear is that, I mean, we have these figures. We know. Other states don't, because we've engaged in a sustained enforcement effort. And you're absolutely right that one consequence of the failure of Senate Bill 181 will be the likely dissolution of this task force. And we can tell you that as soon as this task force goes away, there is absolutely no incentive to pay these taxes. I mean, we are the incentive. And if you take us away, people will resume cheating.
So let me, if I could ask the reverse of that question, given, and this is just obviously just one case, the Nguyens, but given the structure we have in place and our ability to, the penalty was 30 days in jail and perhaps a lien that we might even spend half of the amount of that lien on the house just trying to recover the $500,000, I guess that the concern is we're expending out of tobacco tax revenue a great deal of resources, and are we chasing something that ultimately, other than putting them out of business, which maybe this argument just in and of itself, that will never recover, because the nature of who these people are and how they operate, and they file bankruptcy the next day.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I think that that's where looking at not just, I mean, if we just focus on how much we're able to recover, I think that's only part of it. The other part is that we may never collect everything that the Nguyen's owe, but they're not going to continue cheating the state either. And people like them are going to be less likely because we took away what was essentially their only means of income. I mean, they didn't operate. They had no legitimate means of supporting themselves other than this business. Hmm. And word's out that we're going after these people. The other thing is that this is a white-collar crime, and I think it's a fairly new area for the courts. And I think that it's part of our task and part of the task of this task force to educate the courts as well about the serious nature of the crime. I mean, I think that at first blush, you know, we hear it and it's like, well, they're just not paying their taxes. How big a deal? Who are they hurting? But I think as these cases are promoted and as we continue to do them, I think that the courts will become a whole lot more aware of the extent of harm that these people are causing. And the fact that, you know, we're not just dealing with people who aren't paying their taxes. These people are white-collar criminals, and this is organized crime. It just looks different. And so, you know, we're cautiously optimistic in that regard that the sentences that we'll begin to get stiffer sentences the longer that we can continue.
Mike, I have a question for you, and in fact, any of you could answer this if you'd like. If this, it appears we're going to have a cigarette tax increase, and every time, and when we were looking at that back in 01 and 03, that idea that as the tax goes up, the temptation for avoidance goes up too. And I'm thinking, as Cheryl was talking there about Portland a few years ago, Peter Jennings does a report saying, if you want to sell drugs, go to Portland, Oregon. Well, Portland then got tough on that, and you don't hear that anymore. It's not that good of a place to deal drugs. So there's no question that enforcement is a deterrent. But do you guys have any estimate of what it would look like if we have a substantial increase in the tax and then enforcement goes away? I would imagine we'd send a clear message. Here's a place to make a big bunch of money because the spread is so big between the cost you would pay and the amount you could sell it for.
Vice Chair George, we currently, under our current structure, with the tax as it is, we're locating crime, and we haven't had trouble finding it. So I think it would be, like you had said, it would be logical to assume or speculate that if, as the tax were to increase, that that would even further promote the willingness to cheat, particularly with the OTP.
Thanks. Senator Monroe? He still has no charge.
Oh, you're still in charge. Okay.
That's why I just asked the question when I failed.
No, okay. Couple of questions. Are you going to need additional resources when the tax goes up? Or do you have sufficient resources to do your job now?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I think that you probably get different answers from each agency because our functions differ a little bit. And so I think each of us should answer that in turn. For the Department of Justice at this point, we are not requesting any additional resources because we feel that at least in the short term, we have the ability to reorder our priorities to perhaps, and we're flexible enough at the operational level to be able to turn our attention in the event of a tax increase to the areas in which we will predict and we would see the greatest amount of tax evasion. In the long term, we may have a different answer, but I mean that's how we're choosing to deal with it at this point.
Okay. Cheryl, if I could follow up with that. We have Revenue, Justice, and State Police. You guys are not absolutely dedicated 100% of the time. If you see that, well, we don't have a drop in cases, you shift to other interests within Revenue, Justice, and State Police.
Vice Chair George, with our dedicated staff of the task force, we do not.
Oh, you're fixed there.
We're fixed, and that's what makes us unique is that we have, unlike any other Department of Justice in the country, we have two assistant AGs and two criminal financial investigators whose sole purpose is to work with state police and the Department of Revenue to prosecute tax evaders. And we've had no dearth of work.
So, yeah, I got a couple of more. The other tax, other tobacco products tax. I was actually the one that pushed for that about 20 years ago to so that it would equalize with the cigarette tax, and so I'm very interested in that. It seems like there's a lot of voluntary compliance involved. I just wondered what the leakage is there, if it's significantly greater than with cigarettes, and you feel like you've got a pretty good handle on compliance.
Do you want to? Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, actually it's the other tobacco products tax. That's the place, which is what Lieutenant Dingaman was talking about, where we've seen the greatest amount of tax evasion.
Yeah.
Because the reporting system is voluntary. And while a lot of legitimate businesses here in Oregon voluntarily report and pay that 65% of wholesale tax, a lot of out-of-state distributors do not. And there is a lot of money to be made for the distributor, like the Nguyen's, who are buying non-tax product, bringing it into the state, selling it at a price where the retailers who are buying from them believe that the Nguyen's had paid the tax, and then just pocketing the difference. And because they're reporting based on their invoices sold, the only way that we're able to detect cheaters is if we find a number of retailers who are all buying from the same wholesaler, and the amount of tax that wholesaler is reporting to the Department of Revenue is much lower than what we're seeing given the amount they're selling to retailers.
Mm-hmm.
That's how we find them. So it has been an area, I think, that has been really vulnerable to abuse, and we would expect if the tax goes up, so would the incentive to cheat.
Follow up?
Yeah, one more kind of unrelated. Sale to minors. It's illegal to sell tobacco products to anybody under 18. Do you get involved in enforcement of that at all, or is that just left up to local police?
Chair Decker, Senator Monroe, well, there's a couple things that go on. The Oregon State Police contracts with Department of Human Services on what we have, what we call as a SINAR program, and that's where we go out and do sting operations with a detective and a minor to basically check whether or not some of these stores are selling to minors, and then if they are, they take enforcement action. On the enforcement side, and then each of the counties will sometimes have some of their own efforts that will be doing those things at the same time.
I've heard stories about, especially the little mini-mart type grocery stores that are located near a high school. I've heard stories that they often sell to young people, high school students that are under 18, and in fact some of them sell cigarettes individually by the cigarette. You know, you can't afford a whole pack for $5, so you buy a cigarette for a quarter or whatever it is. Are you familiar with any of that kind of activity?
Chair Deckard, Senator Monroe, no, I'm not.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Starr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is a simple bill. It's a simple bill. It's just the elimination of the sunset. Sunset was enacted for a reason back when the bill was, when the program was created. Do you want to talk a little bit, maybe perhaps in the legislative history? I'm sure you would know, and most of us probably voted for it, but I'd be interested just to hear the rationale for a sunset on this program. Any?
I'm not familiar with it.
Senator Starr.
I'll talk about it.
My sense is that we had just raised the cigarette tax, and so we were creating a new program, and so we kind of wanted to see how it would go and then come back and have an opportunity to revisit. Is that what other members are recollecting?
I think Maz is going to talk about it, but I remember a number of around $90 million expected avoidance, and we were trying to close that gap. Maz, why don't you go ahead and press it?
Senator Starr, I think this the whole process started in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, we did not have a tax increase, but there was a lot of uncorroborated evidence at that time, I guess, that there was a lot of smuggling and leakage in the system. We were losing some of our tax money. In 2003, the session established the funding in a sense, and this is probably part of the policy discussion in front of you today. It took the old mechanism of funding the task force as well as the Department of Revenue collection of tobacco tax from the general fund and put it in the top of tobacco taxes. And at that time, it is when it applied the sunset date. And in applying the sunset date, in a way, it was an experiment of how the tobacco compliance would improve collection, and in the same time, because this is a new mechanism of charging, because effectively, you are taking away what used to be a payment from the general fund that is, in a way, subsidizing the other uses, cities, counties, OHP, and laying it on top of the program now. And I think it was an experiment at this time. The conclusion, I guess, is that this experiment is worth.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I would suggest that the sunset proved its worth for the very fact that we, as a policy committee, are here hearing, you know, what has happened over the last four years, last two biennium. If the sunset wasn't there, who would be getting this presentation? It would be members down on the Ways and Means Committee. You know, they'd be talking about how they're spending the money more than the policy side. So I guess it's a good argument for putting sunsets in bills. My hope is that if we pass this bill, that we don't have to be on Ways and Means in order to hear the update. You know, next session, session after that, but can continue to see how well we're doing in this particular. Agency and combination of agencies.
Senator, do you want a two or three biennium extension of the sunset?
Well, Mr. Chair, you know, extending the sunset would force then, you know, a policy committee to once again look at the issue down the road, and I think that's healthy, but it's not, I mean, I'm not necessarily arguing that we have to do that, but.
So, Cheryl, sure. Can you speak to that? Where would the accountability be if we eliminate the sunset as anticipated in the bill? You have no general fund, so you're just getting a share of the tobacco tax revenue, or whoever should speak to this. Where would the accountability be, say, 10 years from now, and new folks are administering the program, and the worst-case scenario, obviously, would be is that the problem's gone away, but we still have this, we're still funding something that that we don't need to fund any longer.
Mr. Chair, one thought, couple of thoughts. One would be each agency will always be responsible for presenting to their respective subcommittees, but it is going to be a subcommittee of Ways and Means, their policy option packages requesting expenditure limitation for the dedicated staff for the task force. So you would be hearing it, but then, as Senator Starr has said, you're right, you would be hearing it possibly in three or at least two different subcommittees. An alternative may be, I know that in other matters, I used to work in financial fraud and consumer protection, and I know that the relevant committees would ask us to report each biennium on different issues that we had told them the biennium before we were going to address, or that we had told them we're going to be expending certain amount of their revenue that we were going to be spending to address. And so I think that the legislature, possibly through a budget note or a note in each agency's agency budget, could note that it expects each biennium a joint report by the partner agencies to whatever committee you choose, this body and perhaps your colleagues in the House, on the activities of the task force over the last biennium. And you could ask us to report on any issues you like, and we would do that.
Mr. Chair.
We're trying to decide who. Go ahead, Senator.
Oh, I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, it's okay.
I think I sit on the Ways and Means Subcommittee that deals with two out of the three budgets represented at the table here. And it's kind of a, I think it's relatively new. I've been on Ways and Means for a while, but There are now targets in the budgeting process itself, targets and performance measures. So that gives you a real quick snapshot on something like this. I mean, if you had a target of so much return on your dollar, however you measure that, it's just a one pager, and it just really focuses attention on how you're getting toward that target. So I feel pretty comfortable that the oversight is there through the Ways and Means process.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, we do have a performance measure that we've proposed for this task force that actually the three agencies would chair.
Mm-hmm.
So you would be seeing that in each of the agency budgets.
Terrific. Thank you.
I was sitting here thinking earlier when the testimony, these are the kind of things, questions that I think the performance measures ought to have. But a question right now is about the OTP, and that is, why isn't this mandatory? Are you guys proposing a bill to do that? Relative to this reporting, this self-reporting to me seemed like a real invitation, and you guys just said that it was in fact the area in which the biggest evasion was occurring.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, I'll give you part of an answer and then I'll turn it over to Jack Ogami in the Department of Revenue. I think that it is mandatory. It's mandatory that all distributors and wholesales report and pay the tax. But the challenge for us is the extent that we have been able to enforce that mandatory requirement.
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair George, one of the challenges that we face with OTP is the packaging, and cigarettes come in a standard square package, and traditionally we've applied a wax-based heat-applied stamp, and it's been pretty standard and easy to do that. OTP, on the other hand, doesn't lend itself easily to some type of a uniform stamp. And that's one of the things that we've talked about at the Western States and also at the National Tax Administrators meeting, is what type of a stamping device would be acceptable and could be uniformly applied. So there are some packaging challenges that are out there.
Well, so just thank you. So just on that same, what was Chair, you had mentioned something that was voluntary, that was the greatest area of concern, and I think Senator George and myself both thought.
I'm sorry, I misspoke. It's a mandatory requirement that they report, and I guess I use the word voluntary a little bit loosely. They're not required to buy stamps, as Jack just said, so there's no requirement that we can see. That before you sell, you have to stamp your product. All products have to be stamped on the shelf. It's more left to, it's an honor system. It's a mandatory requirement, but it's an honor system because you buy the product. It's not stamped. It goes out on the shelf. It's indistinguishable. Whether or not you pay a tax is not readily apparent based on the presence of it on a shelf. It's just left up to the individual distributor or wholesaler to report how much they have sold. And there's a gap in the extent to which we're able to monitor the honesty of that reporting requirement, or the honesty of people reporting.
Let me try to relate this to gas tax. You know, we pay the gas tax at the rack. If you bring gasoline into Oregon and it's going to be sold to anybody that would be required to repay the tax, it's paid at that point. What you're saying is we can't track the total amount coming in and then identify the total amount that got taxed and say, well, this is the deficit, you owe this much money. That's the problem. And if you could help me here, so with a cigarette, I'm going to be applying something to the product, but on the other products, I'm not. So if I'm inclined to avoid that tax, how are you going to know if you can't check my records? Is the problem that you can't get into the records to see how much did you bring in and how much did you distribute?
Chair Deckard, Vice Chair George, you've exactly described our challenge. On cigarettes, we can just go to the rack and we can see, yeah, that pack of cigarettes has a stamp. On OTP, we can't.
Right.
And so what we have to do for OTP is we have to take a tax auditor who goes into the distributor and says, I need access to your records and I need to perform an audit on your compliance with Oregon's other tobacco products tax. And that's a very labor-intensive process, so it's pretty expensive to go in and find out, discover the extent of tax avoidance.
Mr. Chair. Senator Monroe.
You said that there are some states that have banned internet sales of tobacco products.
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, yes.
Would you recommend that?
There are 3 states that do and 25 that regulate. I mean, that certainly would be a policy decision for the Assembly, certainly not the Department of Justice. It seems like, you know, the reality is that those sales, I think, are going to occur. And perhaps then it would be better to try to regulate the sales than outright ban them.
Okay.
But, again, that's...
Well, I wondered if you'd talked to agents in the states that have banned those internet sales. Do you know what those states are, and have you talked to people in those states, and do they have better or worse compliance because of that ban?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, there were 3. It was Maryland, Ohio, and New York are the 3. And I don't know, Donna, have you spoken with? I'm going to ask Donna Maddox to address that question.
Donna, could you come closer to the mic? State your name for the record, please.
Thank you. Chair Deckard and Vice Chair George, my name is Donna Maddox. I'm with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm an Assistant Attorney General assigned to the Tobacco Task Force, and I've been with the task force for 3 years. I've had the primary responsibility for enforcing the Internet-related provisions. So, Senator Monroe, I can answer your question. I have talked at length with representatives from the Attorneys General's offices in the 3 states that have banned, in particular New York and Maryland. It is a difficult road if you outright ban the delivery sales of cigarettes and OTP into your state, primarily because enforcement against out-of-state entities is so difficult. A regulation allows us to notify out-of-state entities of what the requirements are. When the cigarettes come in the state, we then have the ability to hand those invoices to the Department of Revenue, who can bill. We can also track the illegal activity in the state that is coming from those invoices. If there is a prohibition, out-of-state entities do not report, because a report is an admission of an illegal act. So there is some difficulty, and states have made policy choices either way based on in-state interests, but the regulation has worked for us to date.
Thank you. That's helpful.
Mr. Chairman, we're running late on time. I don't want to get blamed for this.
Thank you very much. Thank you for... who else do we have? Any other questions for this panel? Yes, Cheryl.
I'm sorry, Chair, I have just one more.
You have to yell if you're going to sit there and put the mic there.
Before we close, I think that we had only half answered a question, which was the effect of a tobacco tax increase.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the Department of Revenue's perspective on that would differ substantially from the Department of Justice and the state police because of the function they serve with the program. So.
Could you state that again one time? But the governor just showed up, and so we were,
we were
a little distracted.
Distracted.
We all went, hi.
I'm very sorry.
Go ahead,
Mr. Vice Chair. I just wanted to make sure that the committee had a full answer to its question about the effect of a tobacco tax increase mm-hmm. on the demands of the respective agencies.
Mm-hmm.
I think that my answer might have covered the state police, but Department of Revenue would have a distinctly different answer given their position in the administration of the tax program overall.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, and members of the committee, when we were asked at the Department of Revenue what we would do if there were an increase in the Oregon's tobacco taxes, what we said is we met with the staff and we said the most logical things that we would do is we would seek additional funding to harden the security features on the tax stamp that we already have. We would seek some additional funding to increase our cycle times for our compliance inspectors to go out and look at retail outlets to make sure that there wasn't something new that was popping up to maintain the compliance levels that we had. And we also asked for an additional tax auditor to go out and audit OTP distributors to make sure that they were complying with the tax law. So we're not guaranteeing an outcome, but we're saying here's some logical inputs that we would put into the system in light of the increased incentive to try to avoid the tax.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, number
Well, and if in fact that happens, the tax does go up, and it seems fairly likely that that might happen, I think we need to give them the additional resources out of tobacco tax revenues, of course, not out of general fund. But I want to see this task force have the resources it needs to do the best job that it can do to obtain compliance for all tobacco taxes. And if that, you know, that 65% on other tobacco products, the estimate I've seen goes up to almost 100% if the tax increase passes, or 99 or something like that. So might be, you know, put even more pressure on you, and I for one will be advocating for giving you the resources you need.
Thank you.
I think we're very impressed with the work of the task force. I guess the only question would be, I agree with Senator Stern in terms of some sort of limit, time limit, and what's a fair time limit to give you enough breathing room, if you will, to know that your work will continue, you have a funding source that is stable and will continue. The first thought that occurred to me was 5 or 6 years, but... If we put it in there, and I don't know if you want to comment or think about it, what would be a fair amount of time to really give you that knowledge that you're going to continue, you have the funding source?
6 years.
I hear 6 years.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to work with agencies?
Yeah.
To see what we can bring together and bring it back to you.
Sure, sure. And if you guys either now or want to talk it over and think about what would be a fair amount of time.
We'll do that.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for your work. Did we get everyone? Derek Bischoff? Yes, sir.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Oh, actually, Sergeant Bischoff and Don Jones, just sort of staff present who were...
added confidence. Great. Well, is there anyone else that we have Jones and Mr. Bischoff? Anyone else that? Thank you very much. Very impressive presentation. Imagine you will work with them and keep us notified. Great. Close public hearing on Senate Bill 181. Open public hearing on our work session. On 178. Chris, we've heard this go before and have one amendment to consider.
Yes, Mr. Chair. As you recall, this is the bill that clarifies language pertaining to the definition of unitary business. And last time, the committee had several questions pertaining to the Department of Revenue processes and the Multi-State Tax Commission. And Elizabeth Farshenko is here today to address many of those questions, as well as just provide an overview of the relationship between the Department of Revenue and the MTC. And the other thing, as you just mentioned, was a potential amendment to Section 3, Subsection 2.
And has that been drafted?
It has not been drafted yet.
Okay, so we will not move the bill. Director Harshenko, on this and a couple other bills, we had several questions about just the Multi-State Tax Commission, which I believe you were, I know you've been one of the muckety-mucks in a number of these, not your chair, but I know you've played a leading role in many of the tax commissions in the country.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Elizabeth Harshenko, Director of your Department of Revenue. Yes, Mr. Chair, I was the chair of the Multi-State Tax Commission for 2.5 years, from 2001 to 2003. And actually, in my whole career, I've been touched by and connected to the Multi-State Tax Commission. So I want to talk to you a little bit about what that body is and how the work that that it does shows up in front of you as potential model statutes for enactment. The Multi-State Tax Commission is an intergovernmental entity. It's created by states adopting what's called the Multi-State Tax Compact. Oregon was one of the first. In fact, for the compact to become effective, seven states had to enact it in 1967, and Oregon was one of those first seven states. I'm the statutorily designated state representative to the commission. 21 states have enacted the compact, but the activities of the states that are the compact members have spread, and now 45 states and the District of Columbia participate in the various programs of the commission and have status as associate member states. There are four purposes that are set forth in the compact itself, which in our law is in ORS 305.655. Those purposes are to promote uniformity or compatibility in tax systems that affect multi-state taxpayers, to facilitate the proper determination of state and local tax liability for those taxpayers, to facilitate taxpayer convenience in compliance and in filing returns and any other phases of tax administration that affect them, and to avoid duplicative taxation. There are three big program areas that the states have created. We have a joint staff that we fund through our dues that we pay to the commission. We have an audit staff that typically focuses on Fortune 100 type companies and does audits for many states, going in as a team and doing audits for anywhere from 8 to 15 states. For a single taxpayer, which creates convenience for both the taxpayers and the states. Filing compliance, there's a national program whereby taxpayers who should be filing and reporting in a state but may not be can go to the commission staff and say, I should be filing in Nebraska, Oregon, Idaho, and Utah, but I'm not, and propose a voluntary disclosure to those states and to begin filing. And then the uniformity recommendations, which is what you see in Senate Bill 178 and a couple of other bills that we have presented over the years and this session. And those uniformity recommendations come from the work of the Commission's Uniformity Committee, which is made up of representatives of all of the states that participate in the commission programs, audit managers, lawyers, policy people, and the uniformity recommendations are usually take a year or two to develop, as everybody who has any experience with respect to an issue that the recommendation is going to address brings that experience to the table, and the group talks about what is the best way if either an agency or a legislature wants to enact a model proposal, what is the best way to write it so that it will work, it will be understandable to taxpayers, tax administrators, and the courts. Those recommendations go through quite a rigorous process. They do begin in the Uniformity Committee. The committee provides a draft to the Commission Executive Committee, which then approves it for a public hearing. Public hearings are held either in some of the instances we've had multiple hearings around the country, or hearings that are headquartered in Washington, D.C., but taxpayers can participate by telephone and can, of course, submit written comments. Whatever comments come in or concerns that come in go back to the committee, and with the hearings officer, they recommend to the commission whether changes should be made in the proposal. Then the commission staff circulates the proposal to the states that would be affected by the proposal. So, for example, if the proposal is related to sales tax, it would go to all the states that have a sales tax. If it's related to corporate income tax, it would go to all the states that have a corporate income tax. And surveys the states and asks, if the proposal were approved by the full commission as a uniformity recommendation, would your state consider adoption? And a certain minimum number of states have to say, yes, we would seriously consider either adopting if it's a rule or recommending to our legislature if it's a statute, before the commission will even consider approving the document as a model uniformity recommendation. And so the benefits of this kind of proposal when it comes to either us as tax administrator in the form of a model rule or you as the policymakers for the state, is you've got the best thinking of the states with input from potentially affected taxpayers, so that it's been through quite a process. And the goal, obviously, of any uniformity recommendation is when the states adopt that we're administering it consistently, our courts understand that it should mean the same thing in all the states that have adopted it, and it provides some consistency and predictability for taxpayers. So that, in a little nutshell, is the context for uniformity proposals that you receive coming from the commission.
Great. Questions for... So just on 178, and I'm going to have to go meet with the governor here in a moment. There was the amendment, or the idea would be to make this one prospective. Mm-hmm. Can you comment to that?
Well, one of the things that we've learned, and taxpayers know, is that when the legislature changes the law, the courts presume that you intend some different consequence. And you always have the choice of making something that you do retrospective or prospective only. Retrospective for this purpose would mean that if there was a tax year that was still open for review in the audit process, and the question of whether the taxpayer was engaged in a single trader business was at issue, we would use the new definition. But that definition would not have been in place when the taxpayer was trying to make the determination to file the return, so that when you, if you make it prospective, it would apply to returns that have not yet been filed. So that's the choice that you make. We have currently a definition. Whether a business organization is engaged in a single trader business is very fact intensive. The effort that the states put in developing this particular model language was to get the benefit of all of the court guidance that we've had over the years and create an up-to-date model that reflects the tests that the Supreme Court and the state courts have articulated as they try to flesh out the constitutional requirements of, it's basically the unitary business concept. And so the draft is our attempt to bring all the states up to a level of consistency again in the way that we describe the standard that the legislature wants applied. But we can administer either way, prospective only or retrospectively. It's not that there's a gap and we have nothing in place now. The idea was that this would improve the information for taxpayers.
So what would the consequences be of doing a prospective?
Well, the impact would be that for tax years for which returns have already been filed, we would be using the standard that's in current statute and the rules that we've adopted pursuant to that statute. And the courts would use that statute and those rules when it was looking at older years. And then from returns filed from the effective date of the new definition going forward, we would apply the new standard. I don't know that it's possible to say that there's a revenue impact one way or the other, because, as I said, whether there's a single trader business being conducted is something that's very much dependent on the facts of the operation of the business.
Senator Starr.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Ms. Hrdzinko, for being here. I appreciate your testimony. I have two questions. One is specific to this bill, but another one is more specific to the Multi-State Tax Commission, and I appreciate you kind of giving us some more background on that. In that process, does it allow for kind of public input or public testimony? Because you're talking about changes to the tax code, is that incorporated in your discussions at the tax commission level?
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, the bylaws of the commission require that we give public notice whenever we're considering adoption of a uniformity recommendation. The public who tends to be interested are multi-state business taxpayers, and their associations are very familiar with the work of the commission and are on our list for notification of the public hearing process. And so it's published on the commission's website, and we have a list of interested groups that we know that we need to let know about the public hearings, and then and so they do participate, and so we get participation on depending upon what the nature of the uniformity recommendation is, from law firms, from accounting firms, from taxpayer associations, and from individual taxpayers. Business taxpayers who might be affected by
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up. So then, like, we had this bill, the unitary tax, and there's that bill relating to Nexus.
Mm-hmm.
In those two situations or circumstances, before the commission, business groups, interested taxpayers, did have the opportunity to address in a public forum the multi-state tax commission.
Mr. Chair, yes, Senator Starr, they did. And in fact, we got public comment on both of the proposals, and I believe some changes were made. The hearings officer recommended some changes in response to some of that public comment.
Then just my last follow-up. As it relates to this bill, how many other states have adopted the multi-state tax commission as it relates to the unitary?
Oh, Mr. Chair, Senator Starr, are you talking about this particular proposal?
Yes, the unitary business
this,
definition.
This single trader business definition is relatively new, if I'm remembering correctly. And so I don't know how many states have proposed it to their legislatures yet. We can get that information. The commission tries to keep track of how many states have adopted uniformity proposals. Most of them in the past have been rules. And so we just started to venture into the sort of the model statute arena, recognizing that a lot of the issues that have developed over the years would benefit from more consistent statutory enactments by the legislatures. That there are things that the state tax administrators really can't resolve just by administrative rules.
Great. Thank you.
So we can get some more information for you if you'd like that.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, well, this raised a concern of mine. You say it's relatively new. My concern is if you have a relatively new thing like this, that if you have companies that operate in many states, what kind of safeguards are in place to make sure that they're not subject to double taxation?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, there are two things that I think help. One is that the commission has a special alternative dispute resolution procedure available, so that if a taxpayer is concerned that states are interpreting differently uniform language, whether it's in our rules or in the statutes, they can ask through the commission for all of the states that are involved to come together and participate in a single process for determining the actual amount of income that should be attributed by that business or up from that business to each of the states. So there's a safeguard mechanism that has been put in place by the commission for that kind of thing. One of the challenges is that you are looking at a piece of a very complex puzzle. That puzzle includes the apportionment rules, the definition of taxable income, as well as the definition of what constitutes a single trader business for purposes of where you start determining how much income is going to be subject to apportionment and then how much gets apportioned to the state. So there's the opportunity for there to be either a gap in the total amount of income reported everywhere that the company is taxable or additional income reported exists. And the efforts that we're making together through the commission are to try to move toward more compatibility and uniformity to the extent we can, and then to provide that alternative dispute resolution mechanism when it appears that hasn't happened.
And Mr. Chair, follow up. I guess, and if the company feels that they still have been double taxed, okay, obviously the ADR system is one remedy. Do they have another remedy? If they can demonstrate that despite all the best efforts, they're still double taxed, do they have a remedy of somebody short of court, or maybe court is the only remedy, that they won't have to be double taxed?
Mr. Chair, Senator Burdick, I would say that for our experience here in Oregon, there are two. additional remedies in addition to the sort of multi-state remedy. If a taxpayer comes in, has been audited by us, and we believe that we've determined the correct amount of tax, and they feel that because of the way our law works relative to the law of other states, they always have the ability to argue that to the department, and we have the ability to grant relief under the statutes that we have in place today, and they also have the ability to have judicial review if they are, if they feel that they're being taxed on more than 100% of their income because of the way the law works.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Director Marchenko, one question I have is this, is that it seems to me that the most logical thing to do is do it prospective. In other words, I know where I am now, and I know where you're trying to take me.
Mm-hmm.
When you talk to the businesses that are going to be doing this reporting in the new direction, are you finding that's their opinion of, about how we would be headed if this passed?
Senator George, I do hear that from taxpayers. One of the things that they value very highly is predictability.
Mm-hmm.
And because they've got businesses to run, and they have to, taxes are a very important part of their overall cost structure. And so the tax manager is accountable to the board and the CEO for what the tax liability is going to be. And so we do hear that from especially multi-state taxpayers who already have a fantastic burden doing compliance and closing their books every year, that mm-hmm. predictability is a very, very high value. So when you make something prospective and they know that's the rule under which we're going to apply going forward and we are not concerned about a different rule going backward,
right.
There's a certain value that they place on that, absolutely.
Okay, it's just down to the two of us. We appreciate it very much.
Okay, thank you very much.
So we're waiting for the amendments? And
we do not have an amendment. So.
Okay. And we're in a work session, so I'll close that. Is there any further business to come before the committee? Okay, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 178, and if there's no further business, the committee will be adjourned.
Congratulations.